program is The Poet and the Poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're live recording in Washington, D.C., and today we're featuring Fleeta Brown, who is the Poet Laureate of Delaware. And here she is with an opening poem. Here's Fleeta.
Mrs. Louise Welling spots Elvis at Harding's Market. I felt like I was seeing fireflies, getting little glints, you know, of what's behind the regular. Maybe it was the rivets on his suit, the sunset beaming in the picture window of Harding's Market. I was standing in line with a full cart, ice cream for my grandkids, bread for the freezer, etc. He was in front of me, head ducked under, hair flopping, paying $4 for fuses, I think. He had on a white motorcycle suit, helmet on the counter. I've never been much of an Elvis fan, but when you see someone, you know who it is. Nothing to say about it. What would I have gained saying anything? Put fireflies in a jar, you've got bugs in a jar, dull tails flashing now and then. When you drive down a road, though, through fireflies, they look like an eye opening as you pass between. I wasn't surprised he was alive. My nephew getting married, that surprised me. But Elvis, once a person's all over in movies and records, I don't think he knows when to stop. I wouldn't go for a ride on his motorcycle if he asked me. But when I came out and he was gone, my feet hurt and I felt tired, useless, like I've always been going toward something I can't ever get to.
That's the voice of Fleeta Brown. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Fleeta is the Poet Laureate of Delaware. She's the author of three poetry collections, Fishing with Blood, Purdue, four, she's telling me, and that won the Great Lakes Colleges Association New Writers Award. Do Not Peel the Birches, that's Purdue, and that won the Verna Emery Award. The Devil's Child, Carnegie Mellon, and then Breathing In, Breathing Out. That is your newest book, and we are celebrating today some poems from your forthcoming book, and the title of that is
The Women Who Loved Elvis All Their Lives.
And that was one of the poems that we'll find in that book. Is every poem in that book about Elvis?
No, but most of them are. I did a lot of research. I could almost teach a graduate course in Elvis, probably. No, they're mostly about Elvis, but I'm in there all the time. It's really the story of my life as well as the story of Elvis's life because I grew up at that time. That was my... Elvis and I coincided. We both hit the market at the same time. I was 16 when he was suddenly becoming a star.
I was going to ask what a nice poet laureate like you is doing being a groupie. But I do know that you're involved with music in your own life, that your husband's a musician, mm-hmm. and that, as you say, that this is a popular culture figure from your own era. And some fabulous poems have come out of this. So let's keep going and hear another one. This is Fleeta Brown. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
All right. I'll read Elvis Goes to the Army. As I said, that a lot of these are biographical. One of the things I should mention before I read this poem is that those of you who don't know Elvis's history, one of the really powerful events surrounding Elvis's going to the Army is that he had to cut his hair. And of course, his long hair was crucial to his identity, and all of us worried about what would happen to Elvis when he cut his hair. So Elvis's cutting his hair becomes a very important part of what happens in this poem. Elvis goes to the army. "Goodbye, you long black son of a bitch," he says to his limo as he climbs on the bus to basic training. The U.S. Army has him on the scales then, in his underpants, baby fat showing, mouth downturned in sorrow or fear. It is worth noting when a person chooses to leave his mama and his singing behind, gives over to the faint signals picked up by his inner ear. So what if the signal in a particular case is mundane, the unremarkable desire for clarity, for love? He's more alert than he's ever been, time clicking away with the greater rituals, small appointments, dressing and undressing, tightening bed covers, reciting the valuable gun, becoming part of the diorama where danger is everywhere, a good reason to blend khaki with the earth. Now, 30 years later, uniforms are back in favor, following the lead of Catholic children in navy and white, soldiers of God and high scorers on SATs alike, sure of their place in the universe. This is the Army, son. Even a king like Elvis might hear that and relax at last between what's come before and what will be. The dead hair of the past buzzed off in a second, a battalion of stubs that hope to live up to the example of the fallen. We will not laugh at the shorn head, but will consider a long time the incomprehensibility of our desires and the way we beg ritual to take them off our hands.
Lovely line. What I admire the most in listening is that you can present the fantastic, the fictional narrative, but it is still a lyric poem. The rhythm, as I heard you read, that the rolling of it with the consonants and the vowels make it very musical. And if one is to look at it on the page, we say, oh, well, you know, the lines are mostly uniform. They're not long and short and compressing and expanding, but you certainly, your use of words makes it extremely melodious. Are you aware of that?
I really try. Yeah,
I really try.
Yeah, I think probably most of these lines are five stress lines, and that's not, that certainly could or could not have to do with music, but I'm certainly always aware of the sound and work really hard to get the kind of movement of phrases that will do for me what I want to do with sound.
Right, one line into the other, and you're very good at that. Your juxtaposition of lines is just very silky. I can't find a lump under the mattress at all.
Thanks.
When you teach here, what do you teach? You have seminars, and we get as many as 200, 300 people sometimes. What do you hope to achieve, and what do you tell them?
Well, it depends on what I'm teaching. One of the sessions that I'm running this time is how to turn a story into a poem, which is extremely applicable to this Elvis book and some other things that I've done that are poems that I've done that are like this. The idea being that you can take a narrative, and a narrative alone doesn't make a poem. The narrative is a good start sometimes for the poem, but the poem has to slow time down and pull you down within the story and make you be there in a way that doesn't drag you quickly to the finish of the story, but holds you there some way, and the music does that in some ways. Well, it's not just the music that slows down the narrative, but also how you hold yourself, how I try to find ways to hold people within the line as you're reading the line, all kinds of little signals that do that, and ways to stop action and pick up other pieces of action so that it doesn't always keep moving forward.
Not as easy as it looks.
No.
Not at all. There is craft. Let us hear another. Maybe with this poem, you would tell us the inception of the idea, when you got the idea for the poem, and then how it germinated, and take us a little bit through the process of the creation, if you can.
Sure.
Remember when it struck you, this idea.
Well, this one's easy to do that because it's based on a picture. It's based on a photograph of Elvis. He's sitting at the piano late at night, and all of that's actually in the poem. One of the things that strikes me about Elvis is his deep love for gospel music, which seemed to many people to be so antithetical to the other work that he did, but of course it all comes out of the same base. The gospel and blues and country music all went together to make rock and roll happen. And anyway, he was a great lover of gospel music, and so I sort of, in this poem, you asked how it began. It began by my looking at the photograph, just thinking through the photograph, and of course once I started describing the photograph, a lot of other things happened. And I began to think about sort of what it means. And as I was working on what it means that he's sitting here, the poem just kind of pulled in all sorts of other pieces. It pulled in his whole history into that one moment. At least I wanted it to do that. It's called Gospel, and it's one of a four-part series called The History of Rock and Roll, which is what I just mentioned to you, Gospel. The picture of Elvis late at night at the piano singing Gospel. Everyone has left. There are a few folding chairs and the upright piano. Elvis is lifting almost out of his black and white shoes. There's no music to look at. It's so simple, the way loneliness sits down in the middle of a bare room, and the middle gives way, and here you are in the real music that meant itself to be played. He is leaning to the keys, bringing them to whatever the point was, the typical point of getting washed in the blood of the Lamb, or building a sure foundation, or going home to the Lord. But he is hearing the words as exactly themselves, individual, no reference to anything. I am not imagining this, I know it, the way the words save you by themselves, the hush of the word's entrance like a spirit lamp. Nobody wants anything more than they want home, what home means, struck like a gong against itself, reverberating Gladys, maybe, or Uncle Vester, the Assembly of God Church, Mississippi Slim, Big Mama Thornton, Ernest Tubb, all the way out to the barely audible crowds, the great weariness to come. But inside is the word, encouraged slightly into music, taking the shape of the room until neither one exists anymore, doesn't have to, since it is home already.
That sounded like a gospel song to me. The naming of those names, you know, that really had the richness of a gospel song. You got the tone perfectly right. Did you know that he actually stole something from Big Mama Thornton? You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog was hers, mm-hmm. wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And yet he didn't give her credit.
I
have a poem about that.
Oh,
my only Elvis poem.
Actually, no, I didn't know that. And I thought I knew an awful lot about Elvis, and I didn't realize he didn't ever give her credit. I knew it was her song, but I didn't realize that.
Well, you have won a number of awards. Now, which book was it, Breathing In, Breathing Out, which Philip Levine honored mm-hmm. with an award?
Mm-hmm.
And what prize was that? The Philip Levine Prize?
It's the Philip Levine Prize, right. I was the first winner of the Philip Levine Prize. It was a new contest, and Anhinga Press is the press that publishes the winner of that contest.
Weren't you just so happy, though?
I was.
I mean, I and was. That's a gorgeous uh-huh. picture on the cover of that book. Everyone needs to get that book because it's one you're not ashamed to put on the coffee table. If people don't like poetry, they will love the picture.
I have to thank my good friend Beth Trepper for taking that photograph. We worked a long time on that.
Perfect. It was perfect for that book. This is Fleeta Brown's voice. You've been hearing I'm Grace Cavalieri, and Fleeta is teaching here, and all of the people that come are going to get more than they expected because she goes into the heart of the poem, the how you get there, and she teaches something very interesting which I was observing, which is called clustering. Do you want to just go over that very quickly, what a clustering is to get to the poem?
Yeah, I think actually that's one of the most, I do it myself a lot of times. I think it's extremely useful. It's simply a method of, you come up with your central image or wherever you want to start. It doesn't make any difference. And then you think about what that reminds you of, and you draw the central image in the center of your page, and then you write what that reminds you of. Something concrete is much better than not concrete. And then you don't think anymore about your original image, and you think about what that second thing that you wrote reminds you of, and you just keep the point is you end up with this page full of things, and they look disparate, but it sort of mirrors the way our minds work, say in the dream state, the way our minds work, which is not linear but by association of one thing to another. And then you have this page full of stuff that if you start looking at how those pieces are connected, you can put together a poem that actually is sort of all of the ways that you may not be able to use everything, but you can use some pieces of that, that it keeps the poem from locking up with one thing and brings it into the other areas that your mind may be associating at the same time.
And if you look at it on a piece of paper, it looks like a bunch of bubbles with words in them all over mm-hmm. the place. Like, like those bubbles from a cartoon character, mm-hmm. and they have little sketches, and I've seen her do this on a PowerPoint, and it was very impressive, and it also is the truth. You know, it really is the truth. And then somebody can just go, perhaps they put that aside and then go back to that, and something will leap out of that, mm-hmm. and it will all be connected to you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's all connected.
And it
doesn't, that's the miracle.
And the poem doesn't necessarily have to come out of that central image. It might come from any one point on your cluster. I'd like to read a poem. Actually, it's the first poem in Breathing In, Breathing Out, the book that won the Anhinga Prize. This poem was based on a trip to Albion, Washington, which is a little town outside of Pullman, where my stepdaughter and her family live. And we walked outside to watch the 4th of July parade. The amazing thing about Albion is it's so small that it only has one little main street, one street that's paved. And in order to put together a 4th of July parade, they had to borrow things from all over, from Pullman and all around the region. So if you go to all that trouble to put together a 4th of July parade, you figure you want to make the best use of it possible. So the parade went down the end of the street, and then it turned around, and it came back up the street again. So that's in the poem. 4th of July Parade, Albion, Washington. Everyone's happy, catching candy. There's an army truck, one fire truck screaming, a blue Olds about 1975, two police cars side by side, everything huzza huzza, the band playing from the halls of Montezuma from a flatbed truck, eight kids on bikes with balloons, a dozen 4-H kids in clover shirts, a bulldog with a bow, two hefty rodeo girls on horses, a small tractor pulling prize-winning chickens in their two festooned cages. I can't help it. I get sentimental tears. Damn, I say to myself, chickens, a prize for being chickens. Then, amazingly, here they all come again, back up the street, chickens from the other side, fiddle players instead of horns showing, candy flying again like stars, everything a copy of itself, another chance. Quantum physics says it's true, particles coming and going, the road not taken may be taken. Meanwhile, the chickens move forward again in our eyes. The Declaration of Independence gets signed. We need custom, return. We like to sit sandal-footed in the grass, happily surrendered to either side. Past or future, it's no wonder the chickens win, the way they keep their artists' eyes cocked, lost in the work of being chickens again and again.
I bet that's the biggest thing that ever happened to Albion.
Probably.
I mean the poem.
Oh, the poem. Yeah, I have to say my stepdaughter has it on her wall.
They should put it in the... Do they have a paper in Albion? A newspaper?
I don't think they do.
Hmm. What does a poet laureate do?
Oh, I could go on.
The
poet laureate doesn't have to do anything. It's not really a job. It's just an honorific. No poet laureate has to do anything ever. But generally, state poet laureates or U.S. poet laureates choose some kind of role. They choose something to do. I'm sort of all over the place, I guess, because Delaware is a little state, and I travel around, and I did poetry readings at libraries last April for National Poetry Month. I did libraries all over the state, and I'm working with an ad hoc arts committee, arts leaders in the state, trying to get poetry workshops into some non-school venues like prisons and detention centers and Boys and Girls Clubs and Y's. I really do enjoy doing this a lot, and I let me just give you one little story. I think it was last year, maybe it was in Los Angeles, some young woman came up to me late in the conference, and she said, I just wanted to say that I am just overwhelmed with knowledge. She said, I knew nothing. I live in this little town out in the middle of I can't remember where, nowhere. She said, there isn't anybody around. I've never heard anybody talk about poetry before. I've been writing poetry all these years, and there's nobody around anywhere to help me. And she had tears in her eyes. She said, there is so much to learn, and I'm so excited to find out that there's some, that there are ways to learn. And I just thought, all right, this is very much worth doing.
Let's have another poem.
I thought I would read this little poem that's the last of the series that I read you gospel from. This is the fourth one, and it kind of puts it all together, and it's called Rock and Roll. If you feel like looking at why things turned out this way, if he hadn't become a doctor and married the florist's daughter, if you had risen from the bottom bleacher and taken his hand and danced to Unchained Melody, if he had asked you, if you had worn decent socks, if it had not rained on the church hayride, if he had even put his arm on your shoulder, if your father had not dumped the interior of the old Zenith console radio on the living room floor 5 minutes before he picked you up for the dance, if he had not said during history class that the body is the temple of the Holy Spirit when you had already taken up smoking in the field behind your house, if you had not learned how to make smoke rings with your tongue like little atom bombs, if you had believed in Ricky more than Elvis. Some say the soul is as light as smoke and can get away that easily, convert to a different life. So you kept lying in the grass with your transistor radio, drumming yourself to the ground in case. I have to mention there, I should have mentioned this ahead of time in case you have any problem with the Ricky and Elvis, that Ricky Nelson and Elvis Presley were polar opposites. And this, for many of us my age, was a real philosophical dilemma, that whether or not we were going to fall in love with Elvis or Ricky. Because Ricky was the good boy that your parents would approve of, and Elvis was the one your parents wouldn't approve of. And unfortunately, I seem to keep falling in love with Elvis.
I wonder what this is. What does this say? I'm very interested in the way you carry that aloft with if, starting each of the lines with if, which is such a subjunctive way, such a mysterious floating towards something. Mm-hmm. But then you never conclude. You get to the end of that first stanza, and you never finish the thought, which I think is very important, because if goes off into the stratosphere, and then you come back to earth with some say the soul is as light as smoke. Tell me about the concerted effort that you made there, the thinking part of you that did that.
Well, it felt to me like when I got to this point in the series, and actually I probably didn't write the series in exact order, but I knew that this was going to be the concluding one that pulled things together, that it seemed to me that everything about rock and roll is sort of tentative, that you have all these stories that come to nice conclusions. You have the Everly Brothers singing songs that you know, at the end he gets the girl and it's all fine and so on, and rock and roll is like that. But it's like that only in the songs, that really nothing ever locks itself down that way, that the girls long for the boys and the boys long for the girls, and things just keep going and nothing ever really locks itself down. And also I was thinking, when you're looking back, this poem is really about memory. It's about looking back and thinking about if this and if this and if this. And it never has anything to do with your present life. It's always just a series of ifs. Mm-hmm. And then finally, at the end of this poem, I think it's more my own history than anything else, this thing about lying on the grass with your transistor radio, drumming yourself to the ground in case. Everything is so tentative and scary because you don't know where it's going. And so what do? You lock yourself, you drum yourself to the ground with your radio. You hang on for dear life to your radio, because at least that's something that you can hang on to in this world that keeps floating off in all directions.
We're recording live in Washington, D.C. This is Fleeta Brown. I'm Grace Cavalieri. May we have a final poem?
Sure. The poem I want to read is Do Not Peel the Birches, from my second book. I like this poem. I keep coming back to this poem because, I don't know, it's about my step-grandmother. My step-grandmother was a really very sweet woman. But when my grandfather married her, my grandmother died when I was 9, and my grandfather remarried less than a year later, which has scandalized us all. And my grandmother was a very beautiful woman, and this woman was very homely. My grandmother knew how to swim, as we all do. It's a requirement in our family. And this new, so when I met this step-grandmother, there she was in the lake, 70 years old. My grandfather was having to teach her how to swim. So she had a lot of strikes against her from the beginning, but I ended up thinking she was an absolutely wonderful woman. But I kind of need to tell that because it's part of the feel of the poem. For Grandmother Beth: "Just one scandalous year past our grandmother's death, the second wife stood homely and trembling, ankle deep in the lake, taking on water and family at once. Once, she told me, your grandfather found the box of hair your grandmother saved when she had it bobbed. She said he cried and tried to imagine both wives working it out in heaven. He took this second one, taught her theories of economics, gave her his grown children and grandchildren, money and houses. They used to sit at the kitchen table and eat prunes, the same table where he ate prunes with my grandmother. Regularity took him to 95, although the last year in the nursing home he couldn't remember who she was, and even years before that at the lake he'd call her by his dead wife's name. No, Harry, she'd say, it's Beth, Beth, and lead him back to where he meant to go. She never touched the money he left her, saved it for his children, took in rumors, and lived on interest. Now she's dead, and all Garth Avenue is gone from me, from us, the house, the lilies of the valley on the north side. Oh, it would be a long list, and who cares now but us? This is what I have to say for her, who held a place and saved everything, as if she had no needs or wishes except to be no trouble at all and to die quickly, a light turned out to save electric bills."
The voice of Fleda Brown. This has been The Poet and the Poem. We are recording in Washington, D.C. This is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production is by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. Associate producer is Kenneth Flynn. I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're in Washington, D.C., and today we're featuring our poet at this convention, Pulitzer Prize winner W.D. Snodgrass. And here he is with an opening poem.
I'm sure that all the Shakespeare readers out there remember that in Othello, Iago says at one point, "Who steals my purse steals trash. Who filches my good name takes that which not enriches him and makes me poor indeed." Well, of course, the irony of that is that he's one of the greatest villains ever created in literature. And he's at the moment, he's right in the business of ruining Cassio and Othello, both of them his superiors in every way. Well, this is a poem entitled, "Who Steals My Good Name?" Well, if you have a name like Snodgrass, especially if you have a name like DeWitt Snodgrass, You feel a little like Henny Youngman, you know, who was always saying, "Now take my wife, please. I say, now take my name, please. Take it in vain. Take it away. Just take it. Well, four wives in a row have taken my name. Three were very happy to give it back. I also have a stepdaughter who took my name. And, of course, the first day she did that and went to school, she had changed her mind by the time she came back. I don't blame her one bit. This is a poem about someone who took my name while we were down in Mexico. We winter in Mexico. And while we were down there, somebody got my name and the numbers of my debit card from a hotel. They make up a card for themselves. That man or woman spent $11,000 in 5 days. This is a poem addressed to that person who steals my good name. For that person who obtained my debit card number and spent $11,000 in 5 days. My pale stepdaughter, just off the school bus, scowled. Well, that's the last time I say my name's Snodgrass. Just so, may that anonymous Mexican male who prodigally claims my clan lines, identity, and the 16 digits that unlock my bank account, think twice. That less than proper name's been taken by 3 ex-wives, each for an amount past all you've squandered, each more than pleased to change it back. That surname you affect may have more consequences than getting teased by dumb kids or tracked down by bank detectives. Don't underrate its history. One of ours played piano for his prison's weekly broadcast. One got rich on a scammed quiz show. One made a bungle costing the World Series. My own past could subject you to guilt by association. Should you write anything more than false checks, abandon all hope of large press publication or prizes. Critics shun that name like sex without a condom. Whoever steals my purse helps chain me to my writing desk again for fun and profit. So take thanks with my curse. May your pen name help send you to your pen.
The voice of W.D. Snodgrass. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're in Washington, and Snodgrass is featured here as our star poet. I have watched his career and read his work since the 50s, and Heart's Needle is, I guess, the book that made me start loving poetry, 1959. That work is still, I think, right at the top of American literature. Is that reissued?
Not now. It's out of print right now.
That is unforgivable. Now, what shall we do about that? I mean, there's no reason for that to be out of print. We have enough paper.
Yes. Maybe not enough patience. I don't know. I'm going about the business of getting a new volume. But,
right.
But it's sort of up in the air right now.
And if I were to read your work, we would be here very late tonight. But there are about 20 books that I have titles to. I'll just name a few every time there's a lull in the conversation.
Right.
Heart's Needle, 1959.
Yeah.
After Experience, Poems and Translations, 1968. Remains, 1970. The Fuhrer Bunker, which was started as a cycle of poems in 77, was put on at the American Place Theater, which I remember, and became a play as well. A great, courageous work that is controversial, but still a brilliant and lasting work of literature.
Oh, thank you.
Progress, 1977. If Birds Build With Your Hair, 1979. And These Trees Stand, 1981. And I'll continue this list of credits after we hear many more poems, because the work spans 50 years. I believe that I'm talking to the great American poet. And my name is Grace Cavalieri.
I sure would like to have a tape recording of your just having said that.
Maybe it's because you came along with what I loved. Maybe you came at the time I started loving poetry. Let's hear another poem.
Sure. I'm going to read mostly very recent things. My wife and I live out in the woods back of Syracuse, New York, and our neighbors out there are all farm people mostly, and so we get to know them and their children and so forth. There's a poem called Farm Kids, whom we like very much. For one thing, they learn how to do everything, but also there's a kind of cheerful quality about them. I mean, the farmers in upstate New York are in terrible situations. And nonetheless, the kids who have nothing are just wonderfully cheerful. They're courteous. They're helpful. They speak to you nicely, unlike, for instance, our university's friends' children, who are hard to get along with, who have everything and demand more than everything. Hmm. So we come to be very fond of these children, but they're children who have very little in the way of a future, I must say. We were particularly taken by a young girl who, she looked like a Raggedy Ann doll. You remember those dolls?
I do. Yeah. I had one.
Oh, yes. All right. Well, think of her. This little girl looked just like that. And this is a poem about them and her in particular, and it's called Farm Kids. Hmm. Our neighbors, slim, ragged doll of a daughter. Not, we're told, of his own getting. Breathed out, "You've got so many cookbooks." Each eye a startled, "Oh," as it skimmed our kitchen shelves. "And so much food." Later, straight-faced, she said her mother lives now with her new boyfriend in another county. Hard up for farm jobs, her dad has to drive 60 miles to the factory, getting up at 5 a.m. to leave them where his folks watch after them until he gets back home. Sometimes 5 p.m. We go for long walks every evening. If we pass their trailer, they all tumble out shouting, "Snodgrass! Snodgrass!" The slim, straight-faced one is thought slow by her teachers. There's much she'd do well not to know. The cool offspring of our city friends are driven to special schools, sports dates, parties, given phones, computers, cars, the insatiate stuff that will guarantee they can't ever get enough. Mm. Our neighbors, less keen hungers and kinder drives, make sure they'll make nothing of their lives but lives.
The voice of W.D. Snodgrass. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're in Washington, recording live. The one thing I believe is a signature of your work is that you are able to create character. Hmm. And I've always felt that about the people you create are unforgettable. I will always now know that little ragdoll girl. And there is a theatrical element about your work. So you just told me off mic that you performed in a play in Mexico. There is a tremendous ham inside of that poet. I mean, you are a theater person.
Well, I love theater, and every summer we go to different poetry or play festival, drama festivals, and so forth and so on. But most of my life, I've not been very good very good on stage. I think I got better at reading poems earlier. Mm-hmm. But then I noticed also that, though I could, when I was telling you about getting to play Sir Toby Belch in Twelfth Night, but any of the people there who do much more acting than I do can steal the stage from me.
But it is more your ability to create character and situation and plot in a narrative poem.
Yeah, and I tend to do more with my voice probably than they do.
Ah.
But they know how to handle themselves on stage better.
There are two parts. The poet is rather a reticent person, wouldn't you say? But the playwright or the person who reads theater is a show off. There has to be two parts to the personality. Mm. Or do you consider it all from the voice?
I'm pretty show off.
Oh, okay.
I do an awful lot of reading.
Some of his other books. We were talking about all 20 of his titles, and we have Heinrich Himmler in 1982, The Boy Made of Meat in 83, Magda Goebbels in 83, two in 1 year, D.D. Bird Callying Jenny Wren. You have a lot of birds. A Locked House in 86, the Kinder Capers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know if it was the kinder, more merciful capers. In 86, Selected Poems, and they were poems from 57 to 87.
Yeah.
And W.D.'s Midnight Carnival, The Death of Cock Robin, I remember
both
that.
Both of those were done in collaboration with a painter, Delos McGraw.
They are, yes, they are works of art. Each in his season, 93, the Fuhrer Bunker, the complete cycle, 95, and prose and translations and essays. So before we hear the next poem, would you be willing to try to remember how your work has changed in 50 years? Can you look at it and say, I was this and now I'm that, or not? Is that possible?
No, I don't think so. Okay. I mean, I always try to... I don't want to repeat the things you've already done, you know. For instance, the reason you do translations is because it's impossible. That makes it worth trying to do, so you don't feel real bad if you fail. You didn't think you could do it anyway. And if you just keep on doing the same stuff over and over, you try to take on more new problems. I'm getting pretty old now to find anything new. I keep trying, but it does.
So you
I'm
feel that your career really reflects change and metamorphosis.
But I suspect a critic could tell you more about what the differences were than I could.
Yes.
But I find now that I will be doing a poem and find, here, I can do this, there, and now. I've never done that. And then I will look back at an old poem for some reason and think, there it was. I had already done that 5 or 25 or 105 years ago.
But how interesting that you're conscious of that, of wishing innovation at
times. Sure. Always, yeah.
Well, let's hear another.
All right. Those farm kids that I was talking about earlier, you know, grow up, and then often when they become adults, we will hire them to work for us.
Mm-hmm.
And we live in an old farmhouse out in the woods there, and it's the kind of house that, you know, you don't just try to keep the flies out, you try to keep the groundhogs out. if you go to make a little repair someplace, a little cosmetic fixing up in the corner, you end up putting in a main beam or something, you know. Major things have to be done all the time. Well, if you take down a wall in a house like this, you find the most amazing things in the walls. For instance, if there's room, it's a barn type of building, great big vertical planks with just something plastered over it. You take down that plastering, and there may be spaces between the planks.
Hmm.
Well, in there you'll have at least a foot deep of dead flies and other things. I mean, probably dead small animals. If you take down a ceiling, you'd be surprised what can come down onto your heads. And we did have some people do that recently, and they were astonished by what came down on their heads. In any case, you never know what's going to come out of your ceiling. This is called On High. As the day laborers in our loft pried loose the hand-split, slivery lath, the gray, unpainted plaster, it all came cascading onto their bent heads like Yahweh's judgments, or Zeus's showers on the naked Danae. Dead flies, snake skins, bat scat, a boy's clodhopper, the Christian Messenger for 1902, sex magazines, a gnarled cane, then a cat's carcass. A tattered fur sack flapped around the bones and fanged skull. All fat and tissues gone. Heavy, heavy, what hung over long years, like an angel's perch or sniper's blind, bare inches from our heads, prowled, say, into some dark cranny, snarled tight, the dead flesh nibbled off by mice, its past prey, or battered by some farm child, sparing his rough parents, buried where no one could know. No. A tramp cat crept in out of wetted winds, snow-clotted woods, then frozen in this shelter. It, too, one part of our insulation. The workman, smirking, must have wedged it back in overhead. Their detector and watch cat for cold forces, for hungers that go along with us. Thou cast-off cat of catastrophes, Calvary's scape cat, lar and caretaker spokescat, oh, be kind. Sealed into our new ceilings, 2x4s, and plywood, to which we do not lift our eyes.
Oh, that is beautiful. It is Shakespearean.
Yeah.
And you always sort of turn in a little nursery rhyme or a phrase or a jingle or a mythological allusion. There's a lot of veils in your apparently accessible work. Many little tricks of the trade are in those lines.
Well, I've been at it for 50 years,
yes.
So
and
you ought to
you love
pick
the
up something.
You love the difficult.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, you want to take on a big opponent. If you get beat up by a small man, I mean, that's still like a loss.
What a good way to put it. Do you feel that you're of a school or you're you?
Well,
I don't know anyone quite like you.
Bless you.
I don't feel, it's an American grain, but if you were to look at Mark Strand and you look at our giants in literature and Pinsky, and I would say that your work is inimitable.
Well, thank you. I would want to be that way, but people are always putting you into categories. For instance, they called my work confessional, which I did not like at all.
But it's not true.
Thank you.
Because although you might start with the eye, you are looking at things. You're not
sure.
Just taking the interior
I hope
road.
So. First of all, confessional sounds like it's somebody's bedroom memoirs, and I'm not interested in bedroom memoirs, or it sounds like something religious, and I am not.
Who? But just one person said that, not many.
Oh, no, lots of people.
Well,
is,
I'll have to refute that publicly.
Thank you, please.
Is there any magazine who reviews a W.D. Snodgrass poem?
Oh, I don't know. I don't get reviewed very much these days.
But do you get published very much? I mean, I've seen
in
the American Poetry Review recently.
Yes.
And there's
Atlantic
not...
Atlantic Poetry. Yeah, sure.
The good magazines would not ever turn you away.
Well, as a matter of fact, my career seems to be coming back. Now that I don't need it so much. I'm retired.
Just in time. Your career is coming back, actually.
I guess so. All right.
You were a professor emeritus from Delaware.
Yes.
And then you wrote full-time.
Yeah. You know what Oscar Kokoschka said, the painter, kind of a scandalous man, said, if you live long enough, you will see your career die and be born again three times. But the young girls are always there.
Well, which one are you on? One, two, or three?
I don't need any young girls. I'm with my fourth wife.
And a lovely person.
I'm with my last wife also.
And Kathy is the good one.
Oh, yeah. She'll do. She can stay.
I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we are honored that W.D. Snodgrass has come to this convention to show the world how to do it and how to be, I guess, himself. And that is the greatest gift a poet can give, how to be like no one else in the world and to do it well in the line. So we'll hear some more of those lines now.
All right, this is a curse. And I should tell you, we were just speaking about my wife a moment ago. She plays piano, organ, and harpsichord. Hmm. And down in Mexico, when we go down there, what we've taken with us down there is an electronic keyboard. And, of course, that allows her to practice and so forth. But it isn't at all like having a live instrument. The keys don't respond in the same way. The voice isn't the same. There's a real difference. And we wanted a harpsichord to take down there. And I knew a man who did make harpsichords. And we went and talked to him. And we came to a kind of agreement about how long the harpsichord would be so it would go into our car. What the price would be, and then I gave him a lot of materials to use for this. There was a wonderful apple tree that had been cut down that I cut down in our orchard, and it gave beautiful dark toned, lovely wood. Mm-hmm. And I'd saved that for 10 or 12 years, seasoning, and so I gave him a bunch of that to use in making the instrument. Mm-hmm. We did things like going out and buying old pianos at auctions, and then soaking the ivory off the keys. You can't get ivory for piano keys now, And of course, you want ivory. So anyway, we gave him all these things, but we said to him, we leave for Mexico on such and such a date. If it isn't ready by then, if you can't have it ready by then, don't start. He says, it'll be ready. Don't you worry about it. It'll be there. Well, you know what that meant. So when we went to get it, it wasn't ready. And a couple years passed and it wasn't finished. And I got a lawyer after him. And finally, my lawyer said to me, look, are you sure you want an instrument made under duress? Okay, common sense comes into the thing. And we decided, okay, I'm going to at least have, if I don't get an instrument, I'm going to get a poem out of this. So I wrote a curse about this person, and I changed his initials. It says, it is a curse against A.H. Oh, and I should break in and tell you one thing. The term virginals comes up in this poem. Now, it has nothing to do with sex. And it has nothing to do with people who have nothing to do with sex. It has to do with the a kind of harpsichord where the strings don't go straight forward ahead of you as you're sitting down to play it. They come across your lap. It's a kind of side saddle harpsichord. Anyway, here's the curse. You drove off with the apple wood from that great bounteous tree that stood lightning battered and storm tortured, half a century in our orchard, and whose trunk, 20 feet tall, grew hard, dark toned, and 2 feet through. Then, seasoning for 10 years had lain waiting a purpose worth its grain. You took besides our walnut, spruce, and cherry boards for your own use, and warm ivory we'd soaked loose from piano keys. Grave as a goose, you gave your promise to produce an instrument, made an excuse instead, then, sure as self-abuse, one more excuse, one more, one yet, till we both knew that's all we'd get. Now, if you sell that harpsichord, may the straight-grained spruce of its soundboard, warping and twisting, wrench apart, so irritable buzzing start to breed inside that lengthening crack, and pins slip. Not enough to slack strings, though the true pitch won't quite hold. There, where you signed your name in gold, may random checking split and etch it straight through the words, A.H. may fetch it. Or if you keep it as your own, may it ring with a strong, clean tone at times. But when in public, may Jack swell and jam so that you play garbles of chord and melodies gapped like decaying teeth or cheese. May felts fail so every error lingers long in the ear. And may your fingers slip off the ivory slick as wax, so you play always in the cracks between keys that go limp or stick, tearing your nail down to the quick. May all you set your hand to buckle, breaking your finger at the knuckle, which aging, aching, goes rheumatic, turns your recorder holes asthmatic, your fiddle feeble, and your squeeze box troubled by a sleazy wheeze. May your drum rhythms stumble and alter so that the dancers halt, start, falter. And when you lift your voice, may it wobble as if you had told things not quite probable. May far-flung audiences recognize just what you are. And may the wise try your virginals, guess at their price, look long, but think best not to ask it, seeing its form so like a casket he could go to the boneyard in it before you'd finish him his spinet. Still, may no formal punishment ease your guilt. May each day be spent evading lawyers' calls or tax inspectors, falling shy on facts, on good faith, or harmonic rules. be fearless around power tools. Should you pick up some stranger's kit or find wood, switch on your drill bit. If you should skirt around a law, look up once from your bandsaw. If you should ever break your faith, may loose hairs wander toward your lathe. Lastly, may those you trust in break their word and for their own sweet sake waste your gifts on things to make them comfy till the day you die. Every midnight may you lie awake with one who'll scorn and rule you for a coward and a fool. That is, I hope you spend your life alone. Or better, with your wife.
The voice of W.D. Snodgrass. I was just noting the interior rhyme, the sound, the rhythm, the cadence, the way each line is begun a different way. That is an absolute high watermark. This is The Poet and the Poem. Our guest has been W.D. Snodgrass. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of M.E.T. Studios. Associate producer is Kenneth Flynn. I'm Grace Cavalieri.